Today is Wednesday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for peace in Israel and Palestine takes heavy criticism.
Israel would be establishing facts on the ground that would make it impossible for there to be a viable, contiguous Palestinian state that could really function as a state.
Plus, a UN report says Islamic State militants in Iraq are often not getting fair trials, and countries around the world are evacuating their citizens from China as the coronavirus spreads. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today. President Donald Trump unveiled his long-awaited Mideast peace plan Tuesday alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump's plan envisions a disjointed Palestinian state that turns over key parts of the West Bank to Israel. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas dismissed the plan as, quote, nonsense, end quote, and vowed to resist it. Netanyahu called it a, quote, historic breakthrough, end quote, equal in significance to the country's 1948 Declaration of Independence. But given the Palestinian opposition, the plan seems unlikely to lead to any significant breakthrough. However, some political analysts think it could give a campaign boost to both Trump and Netanyahu, who are each facing legal problems ahead of tough elections. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed the U.S. peace plan with Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now.
This is a disaster. It's a disaster because of several reasons. One is that on the front end, even before there's any negotiations, anything happens, and the Israeli government now announced that it's going to do it next week, it invites Israel to annex large parts of the West Bank, including all the settlements and the whole Jordan Valley. By doing that, Israel would be establishing facts on the ground that would make it impossible for there to be a viable, contiguous Palestinian state that could really function as a state. When there's no viable Palestinian state, Israel, as we see it here at Americans for Peace Now and our partners in Israel, the Peace Now movement, Israel will continue being an occupier, would not be able to be a democratic and Jewish state as it is envisioned to be, and therefore it's an existential disaster as we see it for the state of Israel. So that's one reason why we think it's so disastrous. The other is that it does not provide for an end of conflict. And if there's no end of conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, there would not be peace with normalization between Israel and its neighbors, which is another prerequisite for Israel to live in peace and well-being in the future. So as a pro-Israel organization that supports a peaceful Israel, a democratic Israel, we think that this is a major, major blow.
But President Trump said his plan dealt pragmatically with contentious issues that prevented all previous U.S. administrations from succeeding in brokering a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians.
I say to that he and his staff did bring a new perspective, but that perspective ignores work that has been done over decades between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators and third parties, including the United States, which actually has brought the parties closer and in some occasions over the past 20 years or so, quite close to a peace agreement. So to say that everything that has been done in the past is bad and negative just because it hasn't succeeded in providing peace between Israelis and Palestinians is logically flawed. It's wrong because it has brought the parties closer together. So what we have today is a fresh perspective that does not provide a satisfactory answer to the question of Jerusalem. The administration is proposing that Jerusalem will stay united under complete Israeli sovereignty. That is, does not meet the minimal requirements of the Palestinians. On refugees, there isn't a real suggested solution there. It just said that the Palestinian refugee issue will be resolved outside the context of an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. Those are the two main contentious issues between Israelis and Palestinians. And then on other issues that are issues of contention, such as settlements, borders, sovereignty, and so on, the new, quote-unquote, creative ideas just don't meet the minimum requirements of one of the two parties that are supposed to be parties to a peace agreement. And if you try to get peace between two parties, both parties have to be at least to some extent content with it. And Palestinians cannot be content with what they're being offered.
Given the Palestinian opposition, does the U.S. peace plan stand any chance to lead to any significant breakthrough?
I don't think so. I don't see it reaching any significant breakthrough. The one thing that I would say, and would say it very gingerly and cautiously, is that this plan may be a bit of a wake-up call for Palestinians, a reality check that says that things are going in a way that necessitates a compromise on their part. So that's the only thing that I can see here that is somewhat positive, but the plan as it is, I think, has zero chances of actually materializing.
That was Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. And in China, the death toll from a new coronavirus passed 130 on Wednesday with nearly 1,500 new cases, with total cases now over 6,000. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has the details.
The number of cases of a new coronavirus rose sharply on Wednesday. In mainland China, it's now already infected more people there than the SARS epidemic did in 2003. That outbreak went on to kill nearly 800 people worldwide. The new, previously unknown virus is sparking international alarm. It's spreading fast, with more than a dozen countries affected. Scientists around the world are trying to get ahead of the virus, and Australia on Wednesday announced a breakthrough. A team of scientists said they've developed a lab-grown version of the virus which could help combat its global spread. Director of the lab, Mike Catton.
We've moved immediately to share this with our international colleagues to provide a toolkit that complements the modern molecular techniques that are so useful in diagnosis and development of vaccines and medicines.
Governments and businesses are working to contain the fallout. In the US, the White House is holding daily meetings on the outbreak, and some countries, like Japan, have sent chartered aircraft to Wuhan to evacuate their citizens. Hong Kong, which has been gripped by anti-China unrest for months, is planning to suspend rail and ferry links with the mainland. Airlines, including United, have announced they're cancelling some flights to China as demand for travel there falls sharply. Other big companies like Starbucks are warning of a financial hit. It's currently shut around half of its stores in China. The country is a big market for Starbucks, accounting for 10% of its global revenue. McDonald's and retailers like H&M have also closed some stores. Other places, though, are seeing a surge in business. Face masks have been flying off the shelves in dozens of cities. A Beijing drugstore is being fined over $400,000 for hiking up the price of the masks amid the outbreak. As the death toll continues to rise, there's still important unknowns, like just how lethal it is and whether it's infectious before symptoms even appear.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. Other airlines that have halted or cut service to mainland China include British Airways, Finnish airline Finnair, Air Canada, Hong Kong's Cathay Pacific, Indonesia's Lion Air, South Korean budget carrier Air Seoul, and Air India. Also, an airplane evacuating 201 Americans from the center of the outbreak in Wuhan has landed in the United States. Passengers on board the U.S. government chartered plane were flown to Southern California. They first went through customs and Centers for Disease Control screening during a stopover in Anchorage, Alaska. Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, says all passed the screening test.
All passengers had already been screened twice before they left China. They were monitored throughout the flight. And in Anchorage, the passengers were screened twice more and were approved to continue on to California by the CDC.
Dr. Michael Bernstein, chief medical officer of Providence Medical Group Alaska, said the screening procedures that passengers underwent were routine.
And we have lots of precautions to prevent the virus from being spread to others in the community. It's also important to know that even influenza, which we've had multiple cases so far this year, is an infectious agent that is is it at least as serious with as high mortality as this virus? So it's really nothing out of the ordinary.
Britain expects around 200 passengers to be aboard a charter flight evacuating its citizens from China, which is due to leave the country on Thursday. That's according to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's political spokesman. France and Spain are also preparing to evacuate their citizens. The World Health Organization announced it would reconvene the International Health Regulations Emergency Committee on Thursday. The World Health Organization's Dr. Michael Ryan explained why.
What we know at this stage, this is still a very, obviously a very active outbreak, and information is being updated and changing by the hour. It is clearly still centered in China, with the overwhelming majority of cases still being reported from China. However, there are 71 cases reported in 15 other countries. Of note within those cases is the majority of those cases, apart from six, are associated with travel to China, and of those, the vast majority of those cases are associated still with travel to Wuhan.
Dr. Ryan and other officials have just returned from China to World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva. Thursday's meeting will discuss whether the coronavirus outbreak now constitutes a global public health emergency. Officials in Afghanistan said a commando operation in a northwestern region freed 62 security personnel held in a Taliban prison. The defense ministry said it captured five Taliban guards and inflicted several casualties. The captives were mostly members of the Afghan National Army. Meanwhile, the insurgent group said it killed at least 18 Afghan security forces in another attack. Officials said authorities in Bangladesh, in partnership with the United Nations, will allow hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslim children living in refugee camps to go to school. The Bangladesh government had barred the children from going to school since 2017, when over 500,000 Rohingya people fled to Bangladesh from what the UN has called a genocide in neighboring Myanmar. Instead, the Rohingya children have been attending so-called, quote, learning centers, unquote, run by charities. But Rohingya parents and children had complained that the learning centers only allowed children to play games, draw, and do other basic activities rather than formal education. And the European Parliament is set to approve the departure of the United Kingdom from the EU. With only 2 days to spare, the legislators will vote to approve the withdrawal agreement to end Britain's 47-year EU membership. At the same time, the vote will eliminate the 73 British parliamentarians from the 751-seat legislature, where diehard Brexiteers have been a disruptive force for years, while others steadfastly sought to build a more united Europe. Lawyers for U.S. President Donald Trump wrapped up their presentation in his Senate impeachment trial Tuesday. For more, we go live to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Hello, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
First, how did the defense close things out yesterday?
They pretty much reiterated what they had been saying throughout their presentation on Saturday and on Monday, saying that the president had been completely within his rights to raise issues about corruption in Ukraine before releasing that almost $400 million in congressionally approved aid. They said that that's really what he was trying to get at, nothing having to do with his domestic political rivals or election interference. They argue he has broad powers when it comes to this aid and that he absolutely should not be impeached.
Now, a big question is whether any witnesses will be called. Can you update us on whether any witnesses will be called?
Well, at the latest, we had heard that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is in charge of that floor vote if to see if there are witnesses, said that he did not have the Republican votes to be able to block that witness vote, which means that at least several Republicans are joining with Democrats to vote to say that they want to see new evidence and they want to see witnesses. We would most likely have that vote Friday after we go through this two-day question period that we're about to embark on today.
Now, can you explain what's the procedure for that two-day question period and what kind of impact might it have that witnesses could potentially be called?
Sure. So the question period is set up so that senators can have some input in the impeachment trial, because by the impeachment trial rules, they're actually not allowed to speak out loud. So it's a little bit of an unusual situation for U.S. senators. There's nothing they love more than to talk on the floor of the U.S. Senate. So this process is in place so that they can submit written questions. We know that it's going to alternate side by side, Republican with Democrat questions, and that Mitch McConnell has really asked senators to keep their questions tight, focused, so that they can move through this process efficiently. Once we get through that process, then we will have that witness vote, and that really would be a game changer in this impeachment trial, because by all accounts, we were about to wrap up and have the final vote on impeachment by Friday. That's not the case. If there are going to be witnesses, this thing could drag on for many more weeks, if that's the case.
That was VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Thanks so much for joining us, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has announced that the Spitzer Space Telescope mission will end on January 30th, 2020. Launched in 2003, Spitzer has studied the solar system to the far edges of the known universe in infrared light. By observing the cosmos at infrared wavelengths, scientists could see things too cold to produce much visible light, such as exoplanets, brown dwarfs, and cold matter in interstellar space. Among its many accomplishments, Spitzer studied and identified some of the oldest galaxies in the universe. It also analyzed the chemical composition of interstellar dust, providing scientists with new insight into the elements that form planets and stars. In addition, Spitzer investigated and provided information on the chemical makeup of distant planets' atmospheres. While it was designed for only a 2 to 5 year mission, Spitzer provided valuable data for more than 16 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. A UN report says Islamic State militants in Iraq are often not getting fair trials, and that the judicial processes in the country are not up to international standards. The report, jointly published by the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq and the UN Human Rights Office, is based on hundreds of trials monitored between May 2018 and October 2019. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report says those responsible for widespread atrocities in Iraq must be held accountable. At the same time, it says it is important that those accused of crimes be given a fair trial. It says justice must be seen to be done. UN Human Rights spokesman Jeremy Lawrence says the report is based on independent monitoring of 794 criminal trials of suspected Islamic State militants who were prosecuted under Iraq's anti-terrorism laws.
Prosecutions under the anti-terrorism legal framework mainly focused on membership of a terrorist organization, without distinguishing between those who participated in violence, committed international crimes, and those who joined ISIL for survival and/or through coercion.
The report notes trials of IS defendants generally are conducted in an orderly, organized manner, and judges are prepared with investigation files. However, it says defendants are placed at a serious disadvantage because they have limited access to lawyers and usually are unable to challenge the evidence presented by the prosecution. Lawrence tells VOA Iraq's judicial system is unfairly applied to all defendants, even in cases where the death sentence is imposed. He cites one case that Younami observed in a court in Baghdad in which the defendant was sentenced to death.
The court appointed the defense lawyer on the day of the trial itself. He had not seen his client and had not had access to the court files before the hearing, and during the course of the trial remained silent.
Of the 794 criminal trials monitored by the UN, Lawrence notes 109 defendants were sentenced to death. The report expresses grave concern at the court's over-reliance on extracting confessions and frequent allegations of torture. It says these actions violate the human rights of defendants and strip Iraq's judicial system of any semblance of fairness. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Also in Iraq over the weekend, prominent Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr pulled his support from the anti-government protests that have rocked the country for months. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Mosul now after a week reporting in Baghdad. Earlier today, I asked her how al-Sadr's actions have affected the protests in Baghdad.
Basically, when he pulled his support, what happened was what a lot of protesters predicted would happen. His supporters, a lot of them who were staying in protest camps, they packed up their tents and they just went home. So that reduced their numbers, not by huge percentages, but like 5-10% in some camps that we heard. What also happened is a security situation for the protesters. There's always been security forces and armed groups attacking the protests or trying to make them move back or leave their camps. But there was always the understanding that while Sadr was not a part of the protest directly, they had his blessing and his supporters were there. So there was, the idea was that they were protected just by the fact that who in Iraq would dare to attack a protest that has Sadr's tacit support. But without any support at all, it has emboldened armed groups and security forces, and they have moved in swiftly. Over the weekend, at least 12 people were killed. We think that's a small number. Tents were burned in Basra, and there were shots fired in Karbala, and there were huge clashes in Baghdad. The Baghdad protest, which was more than twice the size it is now, was moved back into Tahrir Square. They had taken over some streets and a bridge. That bridge has now been retaken by security forces, and the protesters moved back. One of the takeaways from this, though, that I was surprised by, that there was very little talk of the protests being squashed, because the protesters insist that it doesn't matter anymore. They will stay no matter what.
So you're currently in Mosul. It's a bit different there in terms of protests. Can you explain what's going on in Mosul?
Well, in Mosul, they are sympathetic with the protesters in Baghdad and in the south. But here in the north, it's been 3 years since Islamic State militants were defeated here. However, people are still reeling from that, and they still associate protests. There was a protest movement that was a pretty regular movement between 2011 and 2014 here, and the fall of the city to Islamic State militants. People here will tell you that some of the protesters did join Islamic State militants. They were calling for the fall of the government. At the time, they didn't realize the militant group was going to be so brutal and so harsh. They thought it was going to be a new, softer Islamic way of running their region. But the main reason people won't protest here, even though they are sympathetic with the Baghdad protesters and do have the same feelings about corruption and lack of jobs in the government, in the federal government in Baghdad, is that they believe, and I don't know that they're wrong, that they will be seen as ISIS militants if they come out in the streets and call for the fall of the government, as that's, this is where a lot of the militancy came from, and they will all be, their lives will be in danger. So people here are staying home and quietly saying, people in Baghdad have it really hard, in fact, harder than we do right now. And people in the south in general, not just Baghdad, need more jobs, more health care, more security, and an end to the corruption. But we can't really do anything but quietly support them on social media right now.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch in Mosul, Iraq. Aerospace giant Boeing on Wednesday posted a full-year loss of more than $2.5 billion, the Chicago-based company's first money-losing year in more than two decades. The loss comes as Boeing's 737 MAX jets have been grounded for nearly a year after two deadly crashes involving the model, including an Ethiopian Airlines flight that went down last year, killing all 157 people on board. Boeing now expects to be hit with a $19 billion bill. Boeing also said it would cut production of its much larger and more profitable aircraft, the 787 Dreamliner, by nearly a third. The U.S.-China trade war has hurt demand for that jet. That's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, thank you for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can also find archived copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jack.